from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
If you were a foreign power looking to weaken America, you couldn't do better than Hillary Clinton's economic agenda.
Donald Trump decides to use a nuclear weapon. What is the time frame between his decision and when the nuclear weapons are launched?
Joe, it's scenario dependent, but the system is designed for speed and decisiveness. It's not designed to debate the decision.
The newspaper industry today is in big trouble. Papers have been closing and downsizing for years, and that affects all of us. Even if you only get your news from Facebook, Google, Twitter, or Arianna Huffington's Block Quote Junction and Book Excerpt Clearinghouse.
We're about to win new medals, yo. That's right, son. We about to take it, yo. USA. USA. Watch out, Rio.
Some of the week's news out of context here in The Wheelhouse. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, to help put the news into context, Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi, Colin.
I think that last chant was Ernie Hewitt in Happier Times.
We'll get to Ernie Hewitt and some of the results from yesterday in just a little bit. Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello once again, Christine.
Hello, John.
Dan Haar is here. He is a columnist for The Hartford Current. Hello there, Dan.
Good morning, John.
So all of that stuff that we put into our montage, all the stuff that we plan to talk about, of course, once again, thrown overboard by Donald Trump. Now, Monday was not a normal day on the Trump campaign trail. He gave a speech in Detroit, which was on script, laying out his economic agenda while blasting his rival, Hillary Clinton.
All Hillary Clinton has to offer is more of the same, more taxes, more regulations, more bureaucrats, more restrictions on American energy and on American production. More of that.
His speech was unusual because it sounded like pretty much every speech that every Republican presidential candidate has ever made. We're the party of lower taxes and less regulation. They offer bureaucracy and bigger government. He even stood silently as hecklers tried to annoy him. So his handlers finally got through to Trump. Finally, he's going to stop all the crazy talk.
Hillary wants to abolish, essentially abolish, the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick, if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know. But I'll tell you what, that will be a horrible day. If Hillary gets to put her judges, right now we're tied. You see what's going on. We're tied because Scalia, this was not supposed to happen. Justice Scalia was going to be around for 10 more years at least, and this is what happens.
All right. Well, with a normal candidate, you might say, that's a terrible joke gone bad. In fact, it's exactly what House Speaker Paul Ryan said after this, but this is not a normal candidate. The remarks drew this response on Twitter from Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy. Don't treat this as a political misstep. It's an assassination threat, seriously upping the possibility of a national tragedy and crisis. And there's a lot more that we can say than it has been said. I'll turn to Colin McEnroe. When you heard this comment from Donald Trump, your initial reaction was?
Well, I mean, I think he still has the capacity to make our jaws drop, which is kind of amazing when you consider all the things that have led up to this. I see this also as part of a continuum. We've seen in the past that Trump will say things that maybe he regards as jokes or maybe he doesn't take as seriously as some of the people listening to him do. So as we went through the season of the primaries and the rallies, you know, Trump seemed occasionally to enjoy, revel in, and maybe even encourage a certain amount of violence at the rallies towards protesters. There were moments where he also seemed to be trying to stir up his rally crowds against the members of the press in the press pen. You know, and then you hear these things like during the Democratic National Convention, he said there were a couple of people that who were speaking that he really wanted to punch in the mouth. So there's this kind of thing. And yesterday's remark about Second Amendment, people could do something and maybe do something about it if Hillary Clinton were president and was appointing the wrong kind of judges. You know, I mean, the problem with this is it may exist for him at the level of an off-the-cuff remark or a joke coming out of his mouth. Maybe that's how it feels. The people listening may perceive this in any number of ways. And really, all it takes is one person to take this as an encouragement of, yeah, that's how I should go deal with this. I should shoot this person. And he doesn't seem to understand the amount of responsibility he has to take for the stuff that he's saying right now. He's a Republican Party nominee. Stuff that he says carries more weight, whether it should or not. I think that's what's disturbing, that he would say that and also say it to an audience and maybe a national audience, some of whom might take it a little bit more seriously than he meant it.
Well, I think that this is so the Wall Street Journal has this really interesting experiment happening right now where they're comparing liberal Facebook pages to conservative Facebook pages. And so I'm looking at the Donald Trump one right now, and none of what we're talking about is showing up at all in conservative news feeds on Facebook right now. You know,
it's essentially a non-issue.
It's a non-issue for them. And I think that as you know, as a presidential candidate, there's a certain sense of responsibility. And I think that the Secret Service has, you know, taken note of this comment.
Well, yeah. And this is a comment that has come from several people, including former CIA Director Michael Hayden, who said what many people are thinking right now. Dan Rather actually said it in a Facebook post. This is a direct threat of violence against a political rival, not just against the norms of American politics. It raises a serious question of whether it is against the law. If any other candidate, Rather writes, had said this about a presidential candidate, would the Secret Service be investigating? Dan?
Well, I think you have to view this in the context of the triad of Trump misstatements. Part of it is what Colin was talking about, is the ability to shock and the things that he says that are irresponsible. But in the broader context of lies, outright lies, this man does not speak the truth. And this isn't like, you know, Hillary Clinton says a few things. This is – he's way – far as an outlier in terms of simply the things he says, and B, in terms of policy, he when he expresses anything in policy, as he did Monday at the Economic Club in Detroit, it's so far out as to be designed to taunt in and of itself. And so, to his credit, I think those outlying tendencies in the other two areas tend to take away the sort of seriousness with which people may take, and I get that it only takes one person, take the outrageous statements that he makes, right? So he's, in other words, what I'm saying is he's a marginal character even though he's not in the margin.
I would gather, though, Dan, that many people listening right now who either are Trump supporters or who are Republicans who are not supporting Trump or who are Democrats or liberals who would have supported Bernie Sanders are saying – I don't know that Hillary Clinton's lies directly to the American people are just something we should shuffle off as not that terribly important.
Well, but even – and we're going to get into the question of objectivity in this, I believe.
Yes.
But even by objective measures of looking at, you know, the truth thermometer or the Pinocchio at the Washington Post, whatever measure you have, he simply isn't – as I've said before on this show, when he came to Connecticut, the first two things out of his mouth were there are 3,000 people outside trying to get in and no other candidate has come to Connecticut, both of which were on their face. It's not that he's saying lies that are sort of – I think Hillary is like a lot of politicians. She's saying things that are twisting the truth. He's just simply making stuff up, and that helps his ability to say that was just a joke.
Do you think saying this is almost an admission that he knows he's not going to be elected president?
Well,
it's just such unbelievable things sometimes come out of his mouth. I think sometimes that, you know.
One thought experiment that has been suggested is, if he were trying to throw the election, how would he behave differently from the way he's behaving right now? And it's hard to come up with some ideas that would work better.
Well, you know, when you talk about outrage, I don't know about you. I was outraged on – or not – I shouldn't say outraged, shocked on Monday. The economic plan, cutting the marginal tax rates by a full 15 percentage points, cutting the corporate tax from 35% to 15%, as he's suggesting, 15 or 25 – no, 15 – is to me, as an economics writer, as shocking as some of these other things that are taunts, because it doesn't follow the playbook of traditional presidential politics. It follows the playbook of the exaggerated caricature of the House Republicans.
I was talking to Phil Blum from The Washington Post about this yesterday. To me, the problem there is that so much – the underpinnings of a lot of his rhetoric are – America's in free fall. You know, America's in an economic crisis. I'm the only person who can help you. So, yeah, the extremity of some of the things you're talking about, Dan, it's like, you know, rolling the car down the hill to jumpstart it. That's like the only way you can get the car going again. But the reality is, you know, most of the economic indicators are pretty good. People are indicating in polling they have a lot of economic confidence. Obama's approval ratings are high. So this might have worked with 13 million soreheads, you know, who could propel you through the path of the primaries. But you now have to get 65 million people on board with you. And I'm not sure that the moderate Republicans, that the swing voters, the unaffiliated voters he needs now are going to react the same way. I don't think a lot of them – I mean, people in Connecticut think things are pretty horrible. But nationally, I'm not sure people can buy into the necessary level of doom and gloom that you need to go for Trump.
But even, you know, I ran into a few Republicans yesterday at the state capitol, and, you know, they expressed their frustration with this campaign and Trump as their presidential candidate on the top of the ticket. And a few of them expressed to me that they would be looking to, you know, find an alternative candidate just to write in.
Well, and look, and we heard this week, too, during a week in which at first Donald Trump was going to try to reset his campaign and have a if Dan doesn't think sensible economic policy, at least a normal type of stump speech. He also officially lost the support of Susan Collins from Maine, one of those moderate conservatives. Chris Shays, of all people, actually showed up on MSNBC to talk a little bit about this.
He was my first choice, my second choice, my third choice.
Joe's too.
But Hillary is my next choice.
Excuse me.
Yeah. No, it's not hard to figure out. Donald Trump lost me a long time ago. He does and says everything my mom and dad taught me never to say and do. He doesn't understand the basic requirements of being president of the United States. And frankly, he's dangerous.
And I'm sorry. And that was him talking about John Kasich being his first choice, second choice, third choice. Many Republicans of the ilk of Chris Shays supporting John Kasich, which, of course, didn't work out for them. Dan.
The Kasich people in Connecticut that I've talked to who are not elected officials are saying that the Hillary is their choice. Chris Shays, that shouldn't come as a surprise. He's what you might call a Clinton Republican. When I used to cover East Hartford, we had Larson Republicans, and that's sort of what he always was, and they're centrists, and that's where you would expect him to be, a Wall Street Republican.
I want to quickly go to Jim, who's calling from Newtown. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Good morning. Just two very brief points. I was very pleased to see how Governor Dan Malloy and Senator Chris Murphy responded. Trump's comments, their interpretation was correct, and their reaction was appropriate. It is, beyond the pale what this guy is doing. And I've gone from someone who is somewhat very concerned that, wow, this guy could get elected, to being convinced now Trump will never be elected. So that's a good thing. I really don't want to see him replaced at the top of the ticket because, you know, this is guaranteeing a Republican defeat, which is fine by me. But I think the threat he poses to incite real violence and what could be a terrible outcome is so severe that I really sort of expect the government to offer some counterweight to that. As a citizen, I'm watching this guy proceed in a way that I think poses real dangers. But thank God, he will never be elected. And I appeal to anyone out there listening who considered that Trump might be someone to vote for. He's not.
Jim, thank you very much for your phone call. And Colin, this all fits in sort of to the next piece of our conversation. You know, a big New York Times piece about the balance, fairness, and a provocative presidential candidate. It asks questions about how the press is supposed to cover a candidate like this. A lot of the things that Jim just said, a lot of the things that we've been saying on this program for quite some time, all fit into this category of watching something and someone that in one way or another offends some sensibilities that many journalists have. Dan brought up a few of them. People who lie, who say things that aren't true, they tend to be people that journalists don't think of too fondly. People who have unusual economic policies are things that economics writers don't really look at too fondly. But for me, a big question about this is just this civility question that we are raising again today with his Second Amendment comments, that there are certain things that feel like dangerous speech. And I think we've all seen how words do matter and words can carry weight and words can incite everything from violence to really, really terrible behavior on the part of supporters.
I think in some ways the drama that's playing out in the Republican Party and the drama that's playing out in the press corps are very similar. So, and each of them asks the question, are we living in under unprecedented circumstances, or close to unprecedented circumstances. There have been other times like this. There have been other tumultuous times in this country. But when you see what Susan Collins did say yesterday about why she was going to be voting for Clinton, it's pretty remarkable. I would just quickly want to just parenthetically say that there's a whole other way that this battle is being fought out. And, for example, Michael London, who's a councilman in New London, said the same thing, that he was going to vote for Clinton. And basically party leadership, J.R. Romano, the state chairman, and Chris Healy, the former state chairman, who, by the way, was born to advocate for a Trump candidacy, basically threatened to curb stomp him. I mean, Healy said, you know, people have long memories. We'll remember this. You know, it seems to me that there are levels at which you are not allowed to exercise your conscience if you're not a high-ranking enough person. But back to this question of press objectivity. Yeah, I think all of us have been asking the question, you know, has this crossed some kind of line where we can't really treat it the way that we would treat a typical candidacy? And I think for a lot of us, it's yes. Even like I've never been objective. I'm not an objective person. I don't pretend to be an objective person. But even for people whose job it is to be objective, you know, simply reporting day in and day out the stuff that he says, and to Dan's point, fact-checking this just cascade of relentless nonsense that just kind of, you know, almost untrue with no real purpose for its untruth. You know, I mean, it seems to me if you do that job, if you just report it, you are effectively undermining Trump's candidacy.
Well, and, you know, he's not allowing certain news organizations, not that they're not going to report it, but into some of his rallies, into some of his campaign events. He's banned the Washington Post. He's banned some political reporters. You know, he's trying to limit, I guess, the ability of the Fourth Estate to do their job. And I believe that we're going to continue to do it, even if it has to, you know.
But I think to Colin's point, Christine, this is what's so interesting is the act of showing up and writing down the things that he says and then printing them in a newspaper, saying them on the radio is something that could get you banned, but is also just it's an act of journalism that's not being subjective in any way. It's just like reporting facts that seem so gruesome and weird most of the time.
Yeah, no, and that's what, you know, I don't see anybody in the journalism industry struggling with that. I think that's our job, to show up and report the facts, not report what he says, but report the facts and make sure to hold him accountable for the lies that he tells.
Can I just say one thing about that before Danny goes? You know, I mean, I do think there is one way that you – I was thinking this yesterday before the gun thing came up. And that is, you know, maybe our antennae are up a little super high now. And like with the baby incident, I don't know. As you go back and look at the baby incident, maybe we made that seem worse than it was. And the mother's kind of come forward and saying, well, no, he wasn't really seriously kicking us out. Sometimes when he says – when Trump says the process is rigged, he seems to be talking about things like maybe – debates or the way the nomination process unfolded for Clinton. We often interpret that as a suggestion that he wouldn't live with the results, the losing results of an election in November, when maybe he hasn't really said that. I mean, the one argument I would turn back on us is, are our antennae so keenly tuned now towards him that we'll jump on anything he does and give it the worst possible interpretation? And maybe there's a little bit of that. I mean, I don't feel too bad about it, but
I was trying to parse the words that we saw from yesterday, Dan, the words about the Second Amendment. And if you took those words in order, and even the way he said them, there are a lot of ways to look at that and say what he's trying to say is that people who believe in the Second Amendment come out to vote, and people who support gun rights may be able to jumpstart a campaign that would take down a possible Hillary Clinton presidency. The fact, though, is that we can't look at anything he says in the same way we'd look at it if, say, Chris Shays, who we just heard from, had said something like that.
I think that in defense of Donald Trump here, and that's twice in this show, that the Second Amendment –
it's noted.
The CCDL, Connecticut Citizens Defense League, strongest advocates, including the group's president that I've spoken with, which is extensive – tend to be people who are very, very strong and rabid advocates of gun ownership, and who are, to a man, and it is almost all men, very peaceful people, right? This is not the crowd that you have to worry about shooting someone. There's a separation, and people need to understand that the Second Amendment advocates are not the people who are the problem here. And that's, you know, it's crazy to say, look, we have a gun problem, and the people who are advocating for gun rights are part of the gun problem in respect to violence. It's simply not the case. There aren't cases.
Except to the degree that they're fighting basic things like background checks, which will result in other people being able to shoot other people.
That the policy that they're advocating for can, in the view of some people, lead to X, Y, and Z. But to say, to connect the fact that the quote-unquote, as Trump called them, the Second Amendment crowd are the very people who are going to perpetrate violence. I haven't seen that.
Well, he kind of insulted the Second Amendment
crowd
exactly
right.
when he said that.
That's exactly right.
And then
that's
why haven't they stepped
that's
up?
Exactly
why
right.
hasn't the Second Amendment crowd stepped up to denounce what Trump has said?
That's exactly a great question. I want to, just please, really quickly, I want to get back to – I disagree. When we're talking about the media and the behavior, and I am also an opinion journalist, I hold the belief that in 25 years we are going to be asked to account as individuals – for how we reacted to this threat to American democracy. And so that's not a position that can be held by a news reporter. And so I disagree with Christine that reporters are not struggling with this. I think there's a struggle, and I think that's precisely what that New York Times column was about. It wasn't saying, hey, how do reporters get to a point where they're opposing Trump? It was saying, how do reporters justify the need in part of them to become advocates for something they believe in that supersedes their role as journalists.
You know, what's interesting about this, of course, is the New York Times piece comes out. John Oliver on his program on HBO spent about 19 minutes of the program just about the state of journalism. Here's a short excerpt.
Between 2004 and 2014, newspapers gained $2 billion in online ad revenue. Unfortunately, in that same period, they lost $30 billion in print revenue. So that's like finding a lucky penny on the sidewalk on the same day your bank account is drained by a 16-year-old Belgian hacker.
He went on to pick apart funding models, digital pressures on shrinking staffs. He made fun of Tronc, the new parent company of Tribune papers like the Hartford Current that Dan works for. I mean, yes, this is not anything that we haven't been thinking about and talking about for quite some time, but it just seemed as though the timing, Colin, was very interesting given the press's role, as Dan said, in this very important political season right now.
Yeah, I mean, it and he went on to sort of connect all that to the movie Spotlight. I don't know
in
exactly.
A pretty funny way,
I don't know how exactly to react to that. To me, I'm sure Dan feels this even more keenly, that some of the stuff that he was talking about with Tribune, like what happened when Sam Zell took over and the horrible initial press conference he did at the Orlando Sentinel, and the stuff that followed with just Zell installing really kind of Trump-like thugs to run parts of that news operation. In some ways, there have been other iterations since then, you know, and I don't know. I mean, and obviously the job of Tribune has been to downsize its news operations. That's like everybody who comes in here basically has that basic job. But, you know, I'm not exactly sure how to connect it to this present moment.
It's a great time to be a corrupt politician.
Right.
Because we are, you know, we're not going to be there to cover you. And the newspapers and the, you know, the large corporations are, you know, more interested in the cute kittens and puppies than the things that, you know, the clickbait, as opposed to real investigative pieces. And, you know, just one more statistic is that the American Society of News Editors reported last year that daily newspapers in the U.S. employed only 32,900 journalists. That was 24,000 fewer than the peak in 1990.
And here's the way, Dan, I'll connect this and what Colin and Christine both just said to the present moment. Look, you've got fewer journalists certainly doing the work, and you've got fewer journalists paying attention to anything from corruption to just what Donald Trump says. This isn't a new trend, certainly, but it does feel as though this is a time at which we could use more oversight, when we could use more people taking a look at what people are saying, holding people to account, and we're getting almost exactly the opposite. And the funny thing to me about it is that Donald Trump seems to make a lot of headway with his supporters by saying just what terrible people we are. I mean, for God's sakes, we're giving them kitten pictures. That's what everyone wants, it seems. But yet, we're the worst people in the world, and Donald Trump is making quite some hay by saying that the media is terrible.
So we're the Daniel Malloy of the professional world, I guess. We can't, you know, if we do it this way, we can't win. We do it that way, we can't win. It's certainly all true what everybody's saying. We still have John Lender. We still have Dave Altomare. We still have Christine Stewart. It doesn't take – listen, we would all like for this to be 1994 again. Don't get me wrong, when we had 400 people and 8 people in the Capitol. But the reality is that I'm going to accuse Christine of inciting – just like Trump was inciting violence. She's inciting corruption here. The reality is that she herself is helping to stamp that out. And it does. Listen, we would love to have more, but it doesn't take a tremendous number of people to say we're still here. And we just hope that there's a model that works that brings revenue to that.
One of the things that was alluded to in the Oliver piece, Marty Baron, the guy played by Leo Schreiber in Spotlight, talks about just how many things journalists have to do these days that aren't connected to the job they had in 1994. And one of the things Tronc has just put through – I love saying Tronc.
Tronc.
One of Tronc's new policies is that pretty much everything that goes up on their website has to have a video attached to it. And reporters or whoever produces the content are often required to participate in the making of the video. Like Dan doesn't have enough to do already. You know, I mean, this job already had turned into much more tightly revolving news cycles, plus tweets, plus Facebook, a lot of social media obligations. Dan spent a lot of time in the past running over to the TV set that the same company at that time owned so he could talk there. And now he's got to make a video to go with his content.
Actually, we're still doing – I did TV twice yesterday. Right. They're still in the building, Colin. Yeah.
Actually, Dan, why aren't you videotaping this right now? You could be getting all sorts of really important Tronc content.
And then you wonder why we're not doing in-depth reporting. Well, there you go.
Dan Haar is a columnist for the Hartford Current. Colin McEnroe hosts the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Christine Stewart is the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. We're a bit late for our break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about what happened at the polls yesterday. Colin's day at the polls, but also the day at the polls for many Democrats. Pretty interesting. That's coming up in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're taking a look at the week's news with Dan Haar, who's a columnist for the Hartford Current, Christine Stewart, who's an editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, an editor, the editor. She's like all of CTNewsJunkie.com. Colin McEnroe is also here. He's the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
We are going to dive deep into the world of audiobooks. I've been sort of converted over to audiobooks recently, but I'm very interested in the people who perform them. Many of the people who perform them become little mini celebrities within the world of audiobooks. I mean, sometimes I'm listening to a book right now that's being performed or read or whatever by Peter Riegert, who's a pretty well-known actor. But a lot of these people are mainly well-known as people who are really good at doing these audiobooks.
Ah, audiobooks. You can listen this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. So yesterday was primary day in Connecticut. And in just a little bit, we're going to be talking about a really big primary day that we had 10 years ago this week. Didn't seem, Christine, like it was going to be all that terribly exciting, but there's some actually interesting stuff that happened yesterday at the polls in Connecticut.
Yeah, so there were a dozen legislative primaries, and it looks like the more liberal, I guess if you were going to, you know, have some sort of theme, the more liberal Bernie Sanders supporter kind of beat the establishment Hillary Clinton supporter in most of these races. And most of the candidates who would be considered, you know, the liberal candidates who were running in these primaries were supported by the Working Families Party, which is a labor-backed organization that really disliked the budget that was approved because there were no tax increases and there were only spending cuts.
And the Working Families Party, again, in certain municipal races, they will run their own slate, but often they are just a party of cross-endorsement. But yet this is a pretty big day for a cross-endorsing party.
Definitely a big day for a cross-endorsing party. You know, definitely a victory for them to get their candidates through, I guess, the first part of the race.
Dan?
I question whether we have enough data. The number of incumbents who voted for the Democratic budget, which cuts at least 2,500 jobs, who lost is, I believe, one in West Haven. Is that the only one?
Lou Esposito?
Yes.
Yes.
I believe that's the – so really the litmus test here for a quote, you know, a reaction is how many people who voted for that said to be horrific plan lose their seats. And so now we have one, and that's not zero. And but
they were
words,
local. They were local races too.
I understand. That's exactly what I'm saying. In other words, based on this, I don't know that we can say this is where the direction is. It's a good day for Working Families Party. Don't get me wrong. But when Senator Moore and Gomes in Bridgeport, who are the incumbents, who are not endorsed by the party nonetheless retain their seats in a primary. I don't know that that's a rebuke to the establishment.
And Colin,
I don't know. I'm not saying it is or it isn't. I'm just saying the numbers are small.
And Colin, just quickly, maybe flesh out. You mentioned Ernie Hewitt in our open. Of course, he was probably one of the better known state legislators to have lost yesterday.
Ernie would be a statistical outlier, I think. I mean, he just basically had some real deportment problems. People haven't forgotten the strange remark about the snake under his desk when the young woman was speaking in a public hearing. I just, you know, Ernie had just problems that probably didn't have that much to do with the state budget or anything else. I will say this, you know, to Christine's point, I think what we have to watch now, and Dan's right, it's a very small sample size, but we have to watch volatility. I think you're going to see more volatility in the General Assembly races. We've talked about this in the past. There's just a lot of retirements and open seats where you don't have to overthrow an incumbent, and there's a lot of dissatisfaction with dysfunction at the State House. And I think that that's going to run through this cycle and through 2018. I think I said it before, but if the Republicans can't win a gubernatorial election in 2018, they really suck.
So I think that the Working Families Party and what a union endorsement or a Working Families Party endorsement means for these candidates who get it is that they're going to receive the door knocking and volunteer support that these other candidates might not be receiving because they voted for a budget in the future. But
so Colin, you went out to the polls yesesterday. An awful lot of people in Connecticut didn't go. What was your experience like?
So, I went to what's a new polling place for me. I got turned away. I was told I was not on the list. I went home. I thought about this a while. And actually, when I was there the first time, I said, you know, I'm pretty sure I got something in the mail telling me I really had been reassigned to this. And one of the – I think it might have been the moderator there said, well, no, you would have had to go to town hall for that or whatever. So I sort of gave up, and then I went home. And then I thought about it some more. I even located the piece of paper. It comes from DMV. It's because I re-registered my license. It says, no, this is where you vote right now. So I go back, and this time they find me on the list. And I just – you know, these are nice people, and they're volunteers for the most part. Or people are giving their – they're donating their time. They're not evil people. This wasn't a voter suppression tactic. It wasn't anything like that. But it's too damn hard to vote in Connecticut. There's too much confusion about what the rules are, the rules about photo IDs. I mean, we know from these Texas cases, photo IDs are evil. But you will always be asked for a photo ID when you vote in Connecticut. And from the Secretary of State's office, you can see what the rules are. The rules are unbelievably confusing and unnecessarily confusing about what constitutes legitimate ID. Here's my suggestion. All you big employers that haven't moved to Arizona who are still in Connecticut, tell your employees that you would love it if they took the day off on election day and worked at the polls. You know, if we had a lot more highly competent, well-trained people who understood the law working at the polls, I think things would go more smoothly. Voting here is too messy. And a lot of that just has to do with this very kind of micro-poised, you know, local control, precinct control. You know, it's hard to get the message all the way down from the state government.
I wonder if we're going to see more problems in November like you had because of the problems with the DMV and their inability to even ask if you want to register to vote, you know, which was settled earlier this week or last week. But their inability to get those application forms to the registrar of voters, that was part of the problem.
They did fine with me, you know, but it was human error at the polling site.
I don't know whether it's good or bad that in Connecticut, in contrast to other states, these problems with the voter rolls are not the result of some malintended policy. Is incompetence worse than malevolence? I don't know. That's the question. I had a very good experience yesterday. I forgot my wallet, and I was welcomed in and ushered in and allowed to vote in that very same town with my employer-issued ID.
Yeah. But that's because you're Dan Haar. I mean, everyone knows who you are. That's much different.
Well, that gets back to our previous discussion about the media.
So anyway, just as a note, the Secretary of the State of Connecticut will be on Where We Live with Lucy Nalpathanchil tomorrow, perhaps to answer some of these very same questions. We'll roll in some tape from you, Colin. I'm sure that she will appreciate that. New Haven Police Chief Dean Esserman is in trouble again after another recent public outburst, at a New Haven restaurant where he reportedly was upset about the service and berated a waitress. It's one of a series of incidents that has caused the police force to issue a no confidence vote. Mayor Tony Harp suspended the chief for 15 days in a radio interview on WNHH with Paul Bash. She says she believes in progressive discipline.
We have seen crime reduced across every measure that is measured by the federal government. And one of the things that I can't afford to have happen is for our crime to go up, for us to lose our babies on the streets. That, to me, is the most important thing.
What Harp went on to say is that before Police Chief Esselmer arrived, there were 34 murders in 1 year. The next year, there were 17 murders. She essentially seemed to be saying that, yes, she does not condone Colin, the chief's behavior, but she also wants a chief who can cut down on the murder rate and do some other things. So she sounds a little stuck here. I will say that Dean Esserman had a reputation that preceded him to New Haven. Many of my reporter friends in Providence said, oh, that guy, he's got a little bit of a temper, seems to be showing once again in New Haven.
Yeah, he seems to have kind of a permanent mood disorder, which may be exacerbated by a difficult divorce and some big alimony stuff that's going on. I was telling Christine before the show started, I'm always amused when Paul Bass's latest piece about this for the New Haven Independent is saying it's not if, it's when. The Esserman's going to have to go. It's just a matter of how they're going to do it. And Paul, because he's so often the smartest person in the room, it's like he's trying to tell them how to like, if you can't figure out how to handle this, here's something that you could do. You could accept his resignation but continue to pay him while you had your acting chief. But that's going to be an expensive solution. I think in Harp's words, you do hear this incredibly poignant statement about the difficulties of urban policing. You want somebody who can solve the racial disparity problems that have been, you know, nationally publicized and drop the crime rate. Esserman does those things, but his rank and file seem to hate him. I mean, the vote on that was startling, you know, just way out of proportion, the degree to which rank and file cops hate him and don't trust him. And so everything that she says in that quote, I mean, it's probably going to fly out the window. They probably have to get this guy out of there, even though he has statistically delivered the results.
Yeah, but it gets to this question about public officials, Christine, right now in 2016. We're all over the map with what people can and cannot say. I mean, we mentioned Ernie Hewitt saying an intemperate sort of weird thing that people maybe still are remembering a couple of years later about a snake being under a table. We can have very long memories about some people yelling at waitresses, and then we have a presidential candidate who is able to say something more shocking almost every single day with almost no consequences whatsoever. I guess I just don't know where to place Dean Esserman's temper in the whole continuum of how we listen to what public officials say publicly or even to just someone on the street.
Well, I think he's in a different position than, you know, a politician is in. He is a public servant, and he needs to be held accountable. And he's also the head of police force. So, you know, any sort of threatening of violence probably held to a higher standard.
One would hope.
Yes. Than, you know, somebody who really that's not part of their everyday job. But, you know, I think that, you know, it's a good thing that there is public scrutiny of these incidents. And I can't say what his fate's going to be, but my money's on Paul Bass.
You know, we also tend to be not outraged, but sort of annoyed when we get public servants who are of the same mold, who never say anything and who are, you know, very sort of quietly secretive and all that stuff. Now here we have the cult of a personality, and this raises the question about leadership and whether in Mayor Harp's statement, you know, he's reducing crime. Really, is it he that's reducing crime? Is there nobody else who can run a 500-person department because the systems are in place? Or is this the cult of a single strong leader? And I think this sort of raises all these questions, but there are two sides to it. We want people to be colorful. We just don't want them to be quite as impossibly badly behaved as that.
There's a difference between colorful and abusive. I mean, most of the documentation suggests this guy is genuinely abusive as opposed to colorful.
Well, and we just got a tweet from Scott, though, too, and I think it's important to note that in our current relationship with police, certainly in urban areas, Scott says, it shows why a lot of people don't trust the police. Bad ones are not removed and further taint the good ones. That's part of the problem, I think, with what Mayor Harp said, Colin, is that she seems to not condone his behavior, but yet he gets to keep his job. Many people in many urban areas across America say people get to keep their jobs after doing behavior that should not be condoned or tolerated. Why is that? Why do they get to keep their jobs?
Well, she set this up. She has some phrase for it. Is it progressive discipline?
Yes,
which
calls,
which sounds like some kind of bondage and submissive thing, progressive discipline. I don't really know exactly how that works. But I mean, so she swatted him on the nose with a rolled up newspaper this time and said, go away for 3 weeks. My guess is this cannot stand. However, you also have to say there's a financial piece of this, too. I'm amazed that Dan didn't bring this up. I mean, he's under contract. He's got another year left on his contract. Police chiefs are really expensive. All northeastern cities are cash-strapped right now. If this were the Department of Higher Education, wouldn't make any difference. They can at any moment have three college presidents for, you know, Southern Connecticut State University, all of them making $300,000. They don't give a crap about that. But Tony Hart may have to run her budget a little bit more closely. So I assume she'd have to put an acting chief in there from the ranks and then eat this guy's salary for a year, and that's not fun either.
Berating a server in a restaurant is not certainly grounds to be fired at that position. You're right, under probably not. It probably wouldn't happen. So you're quite right.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, there's other stuff now. There's now this documented pattern. This 18-year-old woman who's come forward talking about this guy's reign of terror. But, yeah, you could wind up in court with this guy.
Yeah.
You have to accept his resignation and pay him. See Paul Bass. He explained to them how to do it. Why don't they just – Paul Bass for
just
mayor.
Just listen to Paul.
Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent. We're talking today with Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show, Dan Haar from the Hartford Current, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com. We'll be back to talk a little bit more about an ethics investigation going on right now and also about the 10-year anniversary of what was until now one of the craziest ever elections that we've ever covered, Ned Lamont versus Joe Lieberman. We'll be right back in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. As we mentioned earlier, the Secretary of the State is going to be on tomorrow on Where We Live with Lucy Nalpathanchil. You can join her with some of your questions. We're in The Wheelhouse taking a look at the week's news with Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, and also Dan Haar from The Hartford Current. Quickly, Christine, just a few little updates in this ongoing problem that Dan Malloy and Connecticut State Democrats are having. Malloy says he's not gotten a subpoena in this grand jury investigation into the way that Democrats have used money to pay for a mailer. But we do have some questions once again about the oversight agency, the State Elections Enforcement Commission. Of course, the Malloy administration is trying to cut back on agencies, watchdog agencies just like those. I know you've been looking into a little bit of just how effective the SEC has really been in bringing cases and closing cases against people.
Yeah, so this is interesting. So I went back and I was looking at one of the cases I had originally reported about in 2014, which is the same year the SEC brought the case against the Democratic Party and the Malloy campaign effort. And there are still 59 open investigations from 2014. There's actually still 13 from 2013, and there's 75 from 2015. And so, you know, they did lose an investigator this year, so they only have two investigators left. So that's part of the problem. And then you have Governor Malloy, who is, you know, proposing to cut their budget and hold back money from them at a time when they can't even function as an agency as they're supposed to do.
Is 59 cases still open over the course of a couple of years? What does that speak to? Does it speak to their inability to do the work, maybe too small a workforce, or maybe just far too large an ethical caseload here in Connecticut for such a small state?
I can't say because they can't talk about any of these investigations that are currently open. You know, so I don't know if it's that. There were 207 of them filed in 2014, and so 59 are still open. That means that they closed about 148 of them.
My experience, and you have much more experience than I do with this, Christine, is but in talking to public officials, if you bring up SEEK, they're a bunch of zealots. They're out to get us. So the idea but with two investigators, I mean, really, how many cases are you going to clear with two investigators? That's pretty hard. A lot of these cases do involve complicated paper trails or the digital equivalent of paper trails. I mean, really, the truth is this and the other watchdog agencies should be freestanding, taken out from under the executive branch, and maybe actually some kind of dedicated form of funding figured out so that they don't necessarily have to go through the traditional budget process. They're too important to be put in the position that they're in right now.
I think they should be funded through federal accounts with the donations from contractors.
Yeah, the contractors fund the watchdog agency. But actually, I think that's the solution.
That's where all the money is.
Christine's story about the the number of open cases comes despite the fact that the criticism, if anything, is not that they're dragging cases out, but that they're offering settlements too freely. And I think you have to give credit to the two Republicans, Markley and –
And Sampson.
Yes, who refused a settlement in a very similar case in which they used public funding to criticize the governor in 2014 in the case where the governor was not their opponent. They're not allowed to have done that. They refused the settlement, which offered them no penalty.
They are able to do that, but the party or the opposing candidate, who is Tom Foley, would have to pay a portion of that.
That's right. Okay, yeah. So they can't – that's right. I shouldn't have said they can't do it. But I think you have to give them credit. That's dragging out the process even more, and that's going to hold up more cases. But we're at least going to have a decision on whether candidates for Senate and State House can use their money dedicated to them to attack a sitting governor. They're saying that that's a freedom of speech issue. I'm not sure I would go that far, but it certainly is an elections law issue that's important.
We have just a couple minutes left, and I noted this week, Colin, that it's the 10-year anniversary, just basically this week, of the Ned Lamont, Joe Lieberman Democratic primary. When Ned Lamont took on and beat the incumbent Senator Joe Lieberman in the Democratic primary. He, of course, went on to lose to Joe Lieberman later on. At the time, it felt like probably the biggest election I'd ever covered, one of the most interesting, crazy elections, and you were knee-deep in that. Any I don't know, reminiscences 10 years on of the Lamont-Lieberman race, Colin?
The one that I'm going to share, it's kind of triggered by the conversation between Danny and Christine about, you know, how difficult it is to turn out an incumbent, even in a mini-primary like the one that we had yesterday, is I was standing there, I think it was on primary night, with David Pudlin, the former majority leader of the House, who'd become a Lamont organizer, one of the people running the Lamont campaign. And he was looking at the voting totals, and he said to me, you know, getting rid of a sitting U.S. senator who doesn't want to be gotten rid of, it's almost impossible to do unless that person is involved in an act of terrible sexual turpitude or outright theft of services. He said, we're on the verge of turning out a sitting U.S. senator based on his policies. That's almost un-American.
Christine, any thoughts as we look back on 10 years?
That was an amazing that was actually the my first year running CT News Junkie. That was just an amazing contest between the two. The fact that you had to force Joe Lieberman to get on the ballot as an independent that year.
But I also – what's interesting to me, that was your first year running ctnewsjunkie.com, but it was also at the time the rise of these political bloggers.
Yes.
I mean, Daily Kos, of course, the national Democratic blog, took a huge role in this. But there was My Left Nutmeg and all these local politics blogs. And there was, for a shining moment, I suppose, this really interesting world of journalists, non-journalist advocates – all jockeying in the same space to try to tell the story of something that was unfolding very, very quickly, and as Colin said, was historic in the way that it changed national politics.
Yeah, no, that was an amazing year, and so I think it was the availability of the internet, the availability of the tools to be able to build a website that gave them the power, and then the ability to understand that publishing on the internet, you had access to a printing press, and anybody had this access.
So this is a senator who stayed in office through 2 6-year cycles despite being on the ballot in the presidential election and allowing himself to run in 2000 and then losing a Democratic primary. You have to give credit to former Senator Joe Lieberman for his resilience.
Is Joe Lieberman still in the world now, Colin? What's he doing these days?
This week on Fox News, where else, he said that he's been spending a lot of time with his group No Labels, and that he's still considering the supporting Donald Trump. He might actually consider supporting Donald Trump. So here's this guy. I mean, No Labels is the thing he does with John Huntsman, who strongly resembles Ned Lamont, the guy that he ran against. But anyway, I mean, that it's all about sort of civility and comity, you know, and all this stuff. But he would consider supporting Trump, which basically means I, Joe Lieberman, have not been in the news enough. People are not paying attention to me. So I'm going to say something that will make some news.
Isn't he also representing the Scaticoke?
Yes, Scaticoke. I was going to say his law firm in New York is representing the Scaticoke, so he can still claim to be out for the little guy.
I suppose that
MGM backing notwithstanding, which is where the money is coming from.
Certainly notwithstanding. We've pretty much run out of time, and there's so many other things we wanted to get to, but I want to thank Dan Haar, who's a columnist for the Hartford Current. Thanks for coming in, Danny. I appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks also to Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Thanks, Christine.
Thanks, John.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you, Colin.
Thanks, Mr. Dankowski.
Our technical producer is Kyone Wolf. Glad to have you back, Kyone.
Hey.
Our digital editor is Heather Brandon, and the executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Continue this conversation on our website, WNPR.org/thewheelhouse. I just have to make one little correction, because we said earlier that Susan Collins said she'd vote for Hillary. She said, no, I'm not going to vote for Hillary. Not going to vote for Donald. I'll write in Jeb Bush. That's one of the things we can look at this week.
Right in the exclamation point.
Exclamation point, Jeb Bush. This is The Wheelhouse on WNPR. Thanks for joining us.